Well, hello, and welcome to the 8th glorious edition of the Stuff We Like podcast. I'm David Simmons, and for the next half hour or so, we will be talking about stuff we like. And in this 8th episode, we will once again be looking at the arts. Now, regular listeners may remember that in episode 4 of Stuff We Like, the arts, we interviewed filmmaker James Ratnaraja. Just a quick update on his career. He's going to be writing and directing 2 short films this year. His first short film, The Eternal Man, was made last year, and he's following that up with 2 shorts this year, a very brief 2-minute film, and a second longer piece which I've had the privilege of reading already. It's a very moving and thought-provoking film, and I can't say much more about it. It should be ready in the autumn of 2013, however, so keep your eyes peeled as he may be hosting a premiere at a London cinema, which is what he did with The Eternal Man in 2012. I'm fully confident that it'll be a great short film, which, like his previous work, will make people talk long after the credits have rolled. And speaking of movies, if any of you are fans of Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings films, or his Hobbit films, and you've enjoyed the extended edition of the Lord of the Rings films on box DVD sets, be not afeard, as the extended edition of the first Hobbit film will be available in the shops in time for Christmas 2013, just as film number 2 of The Hobbit hits the cinemas. The second film is called The Desolation of Smaug, and it introduces everyone's favourite Sherlock Holmes and Star Trek terrorist, Benedict Cumberbatch, as a fire-breathing, gold-hoarding dragon. So if you love the extended editions of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, then you will love the extended DVDs of The Hobbit as well. If, however, you're one of those people who thought the original Hobbit film in the cinema was extended quite enough, thank you very much indeed, then you will probably want to pass by the Super DVDs. But think of all the fun you'll miss. If you're on your way to a holiday, and you want to take a DVD boxed set to watch, to while away the rainy afternoons, if you are holidaying in the UK, then what do you take with you? For my family, some box sets are a no-brainer. But this is clearly something rather personal, similar to top 5 movies, I guess. For us, if we take a boxed set, it's likely to be a comedy. So we'd probably start with Ripping Yarns, the Michael Palin and Terry Jones masterpiece of pseudo-colonial boys' own tales of bravery, daring and black puddings. Many an afternoon has been whiled away in our household whilst admiring the adventures of Eric Althwaite, the most boring man in Yorkshire, Roger of the Raj, or Tomkinson's School Days, a boy so hapless that even his own mother calls him Tomkinson and tries to keep him back at school during the holidays to avoid contact with him. We might take John Cleese's Fawlty Towers too, although it's advisable to watch only 1 episode a day, lest you suffer from some form of apoplectic attack as you watch Basil Fawlty destroy another perfectly good day single-handed. Then there's Black Books too, the wonderfully surreal series, set in a second-hand bookshop which is presided over by an Irishman, Bernard Black, who adores books but hates his customers almost as much as he hates hygiene. And also by the inimitable good-natured soul Manny, played to perfection by Bill Bailey. Another recent discovery has been the BBC's Shakespeare Retold series, which is 4 plays adapted to the modern day. A wonderfully dark Macbeth, set in a chef's kitchen with James McAvoy. Beatrice and Benedict from Much Ado being updated to a West Country television news studio. And a terrific Taming of the Shrew with Shirley Henderson and Rufus Sewell. That episode is set in Parliament and has to be seen to be believed. Then anything with Peter Serafinowicz is a must. Either his eponymous and short-lived but hugely enjoyable television series. Or Look Around You, series 2, created with Robert Popper and set in a timeless 1970s television studio, where they discuss science and discoveries, all of which are, well, really slightly odd and very funny. The omnipresent Olivia Colman also stars in that series. We might include The Office, with a cringe comedy factor similar to that of Fawlty Towers, or even Extras, which has a similar cringe factor, but also has some terrific star performances and the usual crackling series of scripts from Messrs. Gervais and Merchant. And finally, we would never leave without Frasier, the complete boxed set. The writing, the pacing, the direction, the performances are all guaranteed to be engaging, and they're incredibly witty. In the words of my friend Andy Barons, the reason he loves to watch Fraser is Niles, just Niles. I think that says it all. And one final question, though. Who on earth actually eats tossed salad and scrambled eggs? A year or so ago, a young playwright opened his show in an East London theatre. The play, Act Like It Never Happened, told the fictional story of a human trafficking ring set up in London to benefit from the mass market which the Olympic Games could provide. A few weeks ago, I caught up with the writer of that play, Dominic Hedges, to ask him about his writing, his inspirations and influences, and what he would like to see himself doing in a few years' time. Dominic Hedges, playwright. Why did you get involved in drama in the first place? In theatre?
So, from quite a young age, I've been going to like youth theatre groups, stuff like that. I've always been interested in performance and interested in theatre. And I suppose from quite a young age, I've always been fascinated by how performance, I suppose the difference between like somebody when they're sort of down the pub with you or just hanging about and then that person when they're performing, that's always really interested me.
Well, the change of the person's character, the way they write.
Just the way, I mean, I trained at University of Central Lancashire. I did acting there. And throughout doing that sort of three-year course, I started to find I was more and more interested in watching people change from being whoever they were in rehearsal to the performer than I wasn't actually doing it myself.
Right.
I suppose, although I think there's not a better sort of, I mean, buzz is a bit of a silly word, but there's no greater thing than performing, I think. But I think I directed at uni for the first time, and that's where I started writing at uni.
Okay.
And I think, yeah, it's very interesting watching somebody from what they are before and after performance, and how it also informs the character. I've known people who are very different people after doing a show.
Right.
I don't know how good or bad that is, but it definitely there's definitely residue from performance on the character of a person. So I'm always trying to work with people that have that. So like, as a director, it's good to sort of try and inform what parts of the character should be kept behind on the actor after performance.
Right.
So even if it's a particularly nasty character, that isn't the persona that needs to stay behind.
Right, yeah.
If that makes sense.
I think it does, yeah. Because, I mean, different actors have different approaches to acting.
Yeah.
Some like to immerse themselves in the character 24/7. Mm. Other people, it's just a cloak they wear and then they cast it off and go back home. Although, if you play a particularly demanding part, I think there is something to be said for people. I mean, there is a certain residue of the character that will remain. Mm. It's very hard, I suppose, if it's very demanding, to completely leave it behind in the theatre. That's an interesting thing. So you started writing at university. What sort of things did you write?
So I wrote a play called... Well, I started off, actually. I'm a big fan of David Mamet and his writing. So I did a sort of a take-off of Speed the Plough.
Mm-hmm.
His play about... his three-hander about sort of vicious American film executives.
Right.
And set it in London, and it was a stage school guy who made it good and everyone else wants a job of him.
Okay.
So it was a comedy with me and a few mates. And then after that I wrote a play called Act Like It Never Happened, which we did in London eventually, which was about human trafficking.
Right.
And the effects it has on the Olympics.
Right. Wow.
What
made you want to write about human trafficking?
My wife Catherine does a lot with anti-trafficking charities.
Okay.
And she's always been passionate about helping and ministering to vulnerable women. So I sort of, a part of it, well, all of it basically is from the literature that I'd sort of read, that Catherine was reading, of disbelief in what was happening. And I'd hate to try and even go near trying to write anything sort of vaguely political, or, but it just sort of, it was quite organic, really. I just felt that the group of people I was talking to about it, we all sort of had a sort of similar disbelief, and the writing was happened very quickly.
It was a way of working through that kind of disbelief and saying, other people need to hear about this.
That was it, actually. It was, it was more me coming to terms with it than it was trying to inform anybody. But,
Yeah, I didn't see that. I heard it was very hard-hitting, and I think that kind of thing is very... It's an important, worthy kind of drama. Do you see yourself as always doing that kind of drama, the kind of drama that makes people wake up and shake them in their out of their complacency? Or do you see yourself as more varied than that?
I think I always want to try and make somebody think something I haven't thought before.
Okay.
So I think the best theatre forces you to either make a decision or ignore it. So
yeah,
I think theatre that makes you... I mean, it doesn't have to be politically striking or have any sort of like loaded agenda. But I think unless you want to think about changing or ignore it, like the times in my life where I've changed significantly, I first chose to ignore the choice.
Yep.
As opposed to choosing no, I just thought it doesn't exist.
Right, okay.
So that's what I want to sort of always want to try and do.
You want to challenge that?
Yeah.
Or stir it up a bit?
Yeah. I mean, I did my dissertation on the moral obligation of the playwright.
Okay.
So it's something that's quite close to my heart, but I don't think that someone, because, I mean, someone could do a piece of art, do a piece of theatre that I just wholly disagree with. Doesn't make mine any more valid just because it's got a more culturally positive message.
Right.
I think you just need to be true. And if you're really just out there to satisfy your own creative muse,
yeah,
then I think that is what I'd not want to do.
What's the biggest challenge to you as a playwright when you feel you want to write something with a specific strong message?
See, I don't mind patronising people. I want to say try not to patronise the audience, but there'll always be an audience member that is patronised. Even if how subtle you are with it, someone will always be patronised if you think you're telling them something.
Right.
But I think it's to not make that what drives the plot.
Yep.
Because I think if that is what... I don't like political theatre particularly. I mean, like, obviously Brexit aside, but it's when it actually is the driving force of the plot and the driving force of the characters, because I think that's when it becomes unbelievable.
It becomes almost polemic, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I think I always try and put what I want to say as like a context and then try and find the drama within it, because I find that far more potent.
Yep.
And really, like, unsettling when I see characters that are subject to, like, the environment they're in.
So would you say, I mean, because I read Alan Bennett once said that whatever happens, you must make sure the characters drive the drama. Mm. You want to make believable characters.
Yeah. And then when thrust into unbelievable circumstance,
yep,
you can't differentiate. And I think that's what, particularly, I think, for example, sci-fi.
Yep.
I love sci-fi. And the best sci-fi is when the characters and the settings... Because, I mean, for example, like the old Star Trek, because the graphics were never good, they had to have a good storyline.
Right.
So the driving force was the relationships between the characters, and the remake of Battlestar Galactica, I mean, really hit that nail on the head. The relationship between the characters were the driving force.
Right.
So you can set it anywhere you like. And that truth will always be there.
Right.
Whereas maybe, like, sci-fi I don't like as much, is the emphasis is on the environment, and the emphasis is on
spectacle.
The outside.
Right. Getting the colour grading right or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what are you working on now?
I've written a couple of things. I've written a play set in Sicily, which was about sort of a group of women one particular woman that decides to use the sort of Arab Spring, use that story as something that motivates her to try and start an uprising against Berlusconi.
Wow.
But I mean, that sounds incredibly political, but yeah, it's about the relationships between the women, really.
Okay.
So she hears via like radio medium like it's going to happen.
Okay.
And she wants to go out, but she's bound to looking after her mother who runs this orphanage. So.
Okay. So yeah, there are lots of lateral characters, yeah, lateral situations, but the sure core driving thing is a protest, and yeah, she's inspired by the Arab Spring. Mm. Okay.
I'm actually trying to do a bit of film now,
mm-hmm,
before I'm starting a master's in September in writing for performance. So I want to try and do some film before I right start that in September.
Where's that?
At Goldsmiths.
Okay. Yeah. Writing for performance.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So I've done a short film already, and I've got a short film coming up. I'm filming this weekend actually, and then trying to sort of leap off that and do a bit of a sort of feature, bit of like an hour so.
Right.
And all of the themes are all about change and about guilt and how the two, how guilt informs change to an extent.
Right, okay.
Realisation can do two things, can bind you, which is never a good thing, and can prevent change, or can be a driving force in some, right, in some ways.
Wow. So your inspirations, David Mamet, who else?
Tony Kushner.
Okay.
Like, almost entirely like...
Angels in Rugby, yep.
Yeah. So definitely Tony Kushner. The way Angels in America deals with the supernatural, and Tony Kushner's like acceptance of the supernatural, I think is absolutely fantastic. And it's something I always try and inform in my work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Brecht...
Yes.
I mean, you can't get away from Brecht. Galileo, Life of Galileo, I think it's one of the best pieces of writing that there is.
I played Andrea Sarti when I was a small,
really?
When I was a small guy.
Right.
I played the young Andrea Sarti.
Oh, wow. That's the best part.
I had a fight with Cosimo de' Medici, and then I was supplanted by an older actor in the older scene, so I only got to scrap a fight.
No.
I think I stole my scene anyway. Oh, wow, yeah, it's an incredible play.
Mm.
I was so young at the time, I didn't really read into it the parallels, both metaphorically and actually the reality of dealing with the Roman Catholic Church and the way Galileo was oppressed at the time. And of course, The Good Woman of Szechuan.
Mm.
And his plays have a particular resonance, though they're fairly alienating, supposedly, although I don't actually always find them that way.
Mm.
They do have a resonance in today's world.
And I think that's right, because the alienation, I think the thing with Brecht, because it's Brecht, every play has to be alienating. I think that was just something that he was, like a philosophy of his, like a sort of theatrical...
framework.
Yeah, not all of these plays fall under those parameters.
Yeah,
and I
that's
think
true.
Sometimes, I mean, Mother Courage.
Yes.
I mean, I'd be surprised if anyone can't get moved by Mother Courage.
No.
But however, maybe like Arturo is more clinically alienated.
Yes. I mean, Mother Courage, I saw a production at the RSC, oh, goodness knows, a long time ago with Judi Dench.
Wow.
But the funny thing was the main set was a cart that went around on wheels.
Oh, right.
And it was designed by John Napier, and it went along rails, and it broke down.
Oh.
It broke down in the first 10 minutes. And so the actors started the show, and then Judi Dench came on, the working lights came on, and she said, "Ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, we're the RSC, not the RAC. The cart's broken down. Go back to the ticket office and get your refund."
Oh, wow.
And I managed to get refunded tickets and swap for the very final performance, so we saw the very final show.
That's really... I went to see Mother Courage at the National with Fiona Shaw in it.
Ah.
And almost the same thing happened.
Really?
Before we started, we came in and there were loads of, like, stagehands and people all on the stage, and we thought we were going for a Brexit thing. And then Deborah Warner just came out and said... "Sorry, we're not ready for the second half, so we'll just have to show you the first half, because the cart's not working."
Oh, good Lord.
So we got our money back, and I saw a late performance.
Oh,
maybe the cart's, cursed.
Yes, it's the cart play. We're not allowed to mention it by name. Wow. So, okay, you're about to do a master's. You're writing for film. and you've written for play, for theatre, and you will continue to do so, doubtless. What do you see yourself doing, let's say, in 3 years' time, 5 years' time? What do you want to do? What, you know, where would you like to see?
I'd like to write theatre and have it put on. I mean, I think I'd like to find like-minded people who like my work and who I like their work, and there's a real sort of, I mean, I think working with your peers is so important in terms of developing art. I don't think there's any point trying to attach yourself to someone that you think's really sort of good, or try and be somebody else. Like, so for example, if I met Tony Kushner, I'd want to spend every minute of the day with him. But I don't think there's any point trying to emulate his work or trying to get like a foot up in that sense.
Yes, yes.
I think it's much more important to find people within your own age group, maybe older, younger. You don't have to particularly be friends with them, but just that you respect their creative opinion and make work with them. I think that sort of community element to creating art, I think, is what is really like key. So I'd like to be writing film and theatre and be developing like a group of people that we all start doing work with, and
like a theatre company.
Yeah, I mean, if that's what it becomes. then brilliant. If it's more lucid than that, and people go off and come out and, but just like a working circle, I think that's really important, because you can write something, it can be the best, it can be the perfect piece, but as soon as someone reads it, it stops being the perfect piece and it becomes a collaborative effort, no matter how totalitarian you are about your work. Do you know what I mean?
Totalitarian. So you want your own Stanislavski to interpret your work as Chekhov did? No, that's great. Right. Okay, well, Dominic, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dominic Hedges there, a new and promising young playwright. As his work increases and he gets bookings, we'll be the first to let you know about where you can get to see his work. When I was a young boy, I remember our family going to the cinema together in Tokyo, where I grew up, to see a film about a dinosaur. Now, dinosaurs themselves certainly count within the stuff we like, or at least the stuff I like. But this particular dinosaur was an Allosaurus, which lived in a valley which was hidden from view, but which a team of cowboys and misfits, led by the charismatic James Franciscus, arrive at. At one point, the central dinosaur has a fight with another dinosaur, a Styracosaurus, I think. The special effects which made this movie come alive captivated me then as a boy. The film was called The Valley of Gwangi, and the Allosaurus in question being Gwangi himself, so named by the terrified locals of the valley. The story continues. The cowboys somehow rustle the dinosaur back to the Wild West, where they put it on display, not unlike Jurassic Park 2, I suppose, where the T-Rex mama returns to 20th century San Diego, or King Kong. But Gwangi was, to my young eyes, the star of the movie. A stop-motion animated giant of the silver screen. In those days, of course, there was no CGI. In fact, there was very little C, to be honest. Few people had access to anything as exotic as a computer. So stop-motion animation was the way to go. And there was no one better at this painstaking process than the great Ray Harryhausen. As I grew up, I saw his studio's thumbprint on movies like The Golden Voyage of Sinbad, Jason and the Argonauts, and of course the original Clash of the Titans with Laurence Olivier as Zeus. Harryhausen passed away recently at the titanic age of 92, but his legacy will live far longer. A gentleman who was truly a titan of the cinema in every sense of the word. If you ever get a chance to check out his films, either on TV or DVD or Blu-ray, download or whatever, do so. For a scared 7-year-old boy in a Tokyo cinema, I will always thank his talent for bringing to life the wonderful character of Gwangi, the Allosaur. And in terms of listeners' comments, I have one specific one from Tom Ronan, who would like to heartily recommend the David Bowie exhibition at the Victoria Albert Museum, which runs until August 2013. It isn't just a load of glass cases displaying stage costumes and original handwritten lyrics, which it does, but it's also filled with brilliantly creative interactive displays, themes and concepts about the life and work of the Thin White Duke. So if you're interested in that, the exhibition continues to run at the Victoria and Albert Museum in Kensington in London until August 2013. And that brings us to the close of this episode of Stuff We Like. But please don't go before you follow me on Twitter, at David Simmons, or Pinterest. Check it out, Pinterest Stuff We Like, where you can see all the stuff that we talk about every week. And you can also email me at Outlook, dhsimmons@outlook.com. And if you're interested in being interviewed and want to talk about anything that we have covered, be it food or drink, technology, travel, or the arts, please get in touch with me at any of my contact details and we can arrange an interview. I'm David Simmons, and this podcast has been brought to you by Absolute Productions, a division of Absolute Communications.